for a more progressive candidate.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us. Greg Kassar, former labor organizer and Austin City Council member, currently running for Congress in Texas Congressional District 35. It is the first primary in the country of 2022. The whole country is watching. And we want to thank Anthony Gutierrez, executive director of Common Cause Texas. That does it for our show. Very happy belated birthdays to Messiah Rhodes, Brendan Allen, and Danielle Wu. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for Human Resources Manager. Check out the job at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Moving On is broadcast on KBOO every Friday, right after the noon news to 1:30. On Friday, February 25th, Moving On will present part two of a celebration of Black History Month. We'll hear music from the Civil Rights Movement, as well as from contemporary folk performers Laura Love, Rhiannon Giddens, Reggie Harris, and more. Tune in Friday, February 25th, right after the noon news to celebrate Black History Month, only on KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Sandy Hook parents secure a landmark settlement with Remington Arms Manufacturer. The family of a man killed by Portland police in June will sue for wrongful death. And China and Russia's opposition to NATO. Is there more than meets the eye? Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 15th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Parents of children killed in the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary won a major legal victory against the arms manufacturer Remington. The settlement is a landmark case, as it is the first that holds an individual gun company accountable for how it markets its products. The payout to the family is $73 million and a document disclosure of high-level marketing materials at the company. Documents that show how the company markets and strategizes around its product will be made public. Remington has since gone bankrupt. Joshua Koskoff is the attorney for the families. He held a press conference today after the victory. Here are some of his remarks.
So when the Sandy Hook families came to see us, it was about 9 years ago, and it was in the aftermath of shattering loss, and they were stunned, and they didn't know what to do or where to go. But they did know that they wanted to do one thing. They had the energy and drive and motivation to do one thing, and that was to do whatever they could so that other families, whether they are in a suburb or a township or a city, would not have to go through the kind of pain and loss that they had. To answer the question about what they could do, first we had to figure out where to start. Where do you start? I will admit that I always, when I saw the weapon, and it is a weapon, it's not a firearm, it's not a modern sporting rifle, it's not a family Swiss Army knife, it's a combat weapon. It's a combat weapon. And when I saw it, I didn't know it was a combat weapon at the time. I just thought, what is that thing? I've never seen anything like it. So I figured I better do my homework and learn about it. We all did. So here's what you need to know about the AR-15 combat rifle. And I'm showing you the document because if anybody tries to tell you the commercial AR-15 is not much more dangerous than a toaster or any other weapon even or firearm, you should have this at your disposal. Because this is the most independent, objective, and chilling evidence of what an AR-15 is. When it came to the military looking for the best weapon, the most lethal weapon, the most destructive weapon, and the weapon that could provide our soldiers, should they be forced to shoot and kill the enemies of our country and of our freedom, they chose the AR-15. They chose it. The greatest military in the world, which could have had any weapon, chose the AR-15. But this case was never about damages in the sense of compensation. It was about damages in the sense of forcing change. It was about damages in the sense of realizing the goals of these families to do whatever they can to help prevent the next Sandy Hook. And if there's any message that you get after learning about all this is, they don't care about it's money that gets their attention. It's money that gets any industry's attention, especially this industry that is so not used to parting with it, and especially those who underwrite the industry, like the insurance companies. So it was really important that they get damages, and it was really important that they get a lot of damages, because it has to be something that gets the attention of this industry and its in the insurance and banking industries.
That was attorney Joshua Koskoff, who successfully represented Sandy Hook families in their landmark case against the arms manufacturer Remington. He also said that the settlement was an important signal to insurers and banks that there can be significant financial risk to supporting companies who make their profits by, quote, escalating risk. The parents of those killed in the shooting, some who were as young as 6, have been fighting this legal battle for 10 years now, since the shooting in 2012. Michael Ray Townsend was killed by Portland police in June after he called 911 for help. Now his estate is filing a wrongful death lawsuit against the city, but they don't want monetary damages. Instead, his family wants an order requiring the city of Portland to better train their officers for welfare check calls and for city dispatchers to try to get more of those calls redirected to mental health services. Townsend was shot and killed by Portland police officer Curtis Brown after he called 911 saying he was experiencing suicidal thoughts. When officers arrived at the scene, Townsend said he wanted to go to the hospital. The officers insisted he had to be pat down first, and Townsend refused, pulling a pointed tool out of his pocket. Brown then shot Townsend. The lawsuit was filed in Multnomah County Circuit Court, and it says the city should have sent more qualified mental health professionals to help Townsend instead of the cops. The lawsuit says there were a number of services his call could have been directed to and that the city failed. Since 2014, the city of Portland has been under a settlement agreement from the Federal Department of Justice for its pattern of excessive violence against people experiencing mental health crises. The Oregon Health Authority plans to lift the statewide indoor mask mandate by March 31st. The authority made this decision because an estimated 400 Oregonians will be in the hospital at that time. That's where we were before the Omicron variant hit. Additionally, more Oregonians are vaccinated, and there are now treatments aimed at preventing serious complications from COVID. If hospitalization rates are higher, messaging about masking and social distancing will increase in frequency and intensity, but the mask mandates will still be lifted. The OHA does still advise using masks after March 31st, especially in K-12 schools. The schools will decide themselves about requiring masks based on their own experiences, as will businesses and employers. At least 10 states have lifted or will lift their mask mandates soon. That includes Washington, California, Hawaii, New York State, and Washington, D.C. Currently, hospitalizations remain above 1,000 people per day in Oregon. A bill in the Washington State House would help workers who perform repetitive tasks on the job. It also aims to provide better training on those tasks. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Performing the same motion over and over on the job can increase workers' risk of getting hurt. A bill in Olympia aims to protect them with training on better practices. An initiative from 2003 prohibits the Department of Labor and Industries from putting regulations in place to prevent repetitive motion injuries. House Bill 1837 would repeal that. Trudy Hobbs is a school custodian in the Othello School District in Southwest Washington and has testified in favor of the measure. She says she sacrificed her health to serve the kids in her district.
I've been an employee in my district since 1993, you know, approaching 30 years, and I would like to be able to complete my service with my district in fair health, because right now it's not looking very good.
Hobbs says she sustained several injuries from work, including a shoulder tear and a knee injury that required surgery. HB 1837 would allow for ergonomic training so workers learn how to perform physical tasks without hurting themselves. Opponents say the bill would lead to costly and overly burdensome rules for businesses. Hobbs says the legislation likely won't affect her, since she could retire soon, but notes it would help workers down the road. She also points out that custodians and other workers have been essential during the pandemic.
I just think that we need a little assistance to do our job smarter, and there's got to be some help on the horizon. And I hope that the House Bill 1837 is part of that answer.
The bill has garnered support from education and healthcare unions like Hobbs, Public School Employees and Service Employees International Union Healthcare 1948, as well as statewide unions. Opposing groups include the Building Industry Association of Washington and Washington Food Industry Association. The bill currently is in the House Rules Committee. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Low-income families across the U.S. are struggling after the expanded tax credit ended in December, with parents now missing out on 2 months of payment. Emily Scott has more on the story in Pennsylvania.
The future of the trillion-dollar Build Back Better Act remains stalled in the U.S. Senate, and with it, the expanded child tax credit. After 2 months without the monthly payments that many families came to rely on, they're finding themselves in difficult positions. Expanding the child tax credit was viewed as one of the most important parts of Biden's American Rescue Plan, providing parents from $3,000 to $3,600 per child during 2021, split into 6 monthly payments. Annette, a mother of two, says the credit helped her take care of her family and afford to go back to college.
It's been helping me be able to do more for my kids. And trying to go back to school, it's been helping me in that because I have to pay for school. It helps us low-income mothers better ourselves.
Annette receives support from the Magnolia Mothers Trust, which gives $1,000 per month for 12 months to families headed by Black women living in federally subsidized housing. Build Back Better has been held up by some Senate lawmakers, who say it's too ambitious and have criticized provisions such as paid family leave due to their cost. Sharika, a home health aide and mother of three, used her child tax credit payments to take time off to care for her new baby. She says the monthly checks helped her focus on saving money for the future.
It's helping me keep up with my bills. I was able to do school shopping and things like that. But yeah, it helps out a lot. It lifts the burden up on my shoulder because now I don't have to turn to no one. With the child tax credit, that gives me a leeway to put some back, you know, just to fall back on hard times.
The child tax credit has reverted back to its original version, in which families that qualify can receive up to $2,000 in a one-time tax credit this year. This story was produced with original reporting from Katie Flesher at Miss Magazine. I'm Emily Scott with Keystone State News Connection.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for It Did Happen Here. At 6, we'll hear Transpositive PDX, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 43 degrees. Tomorrow, those clouds continue with a high of 53. Today in history, in 1948, American cartoonist, editor, and comics advocate Art Spiegelman was born. He is best known for his graphic novel Mouse, which is about his relationship with his father, a Holocaust survivor. Mouse won a Pulitzer Prize in 1992 and has gained a reputation as a pivotal work. In recent months, the book was banned in Tennessee. The quote of the day is from Spiegelman, who said, quote, "Comics are a gateway drug to literacy." After nearly a week, Canadian officials cleared blockades on a crucial U.S.-Canada roadway this Sunday. The blockades were mounted on Ambassador Bridge by protesters against vaccine mandates 6 days prior. The bridge connects Windsor, Canada to Detroit, Michigan. It's a crucial roadway for trade between the two countries. The Ambassador Bridge protest is one of many spin-offs tied to what is being called the Freedom Convoy. It started against vaccination mandates for truckers crossing the border and evolved into opposition of Trudeau's government and pandemic restrictions. The number of active demonstrators grew to as many as 4,000 before orders to disperse were made last Friday. Over 25 people were arrested and 5 vehicles were seized the following day. The crowds continued to grow despite police efforts but dwindled overnight as temperatures dropped into the teens. The call to disperse the crowds were made after the demonstrations effectively stalled the flow of goods between the United States and Canada. The audio industry on both sides of the border were especially impacted. It's estimated that each day of the bridge closure affected nearly $400 million in cross-border transactions. The mayor of Windsor, Drew Dilkins, announced early on Sunday the demonstration had ended, but protests against vaccine mandates continue on to their third week in Canada's capital city. The United States says there's still time for diplomacy with Russia over Ukraine, and Washington, D.C. drops its vaccine mandate. With those stories and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We want to resolve this through dialogue, through diplomacy, through communication. We hope the Russians have a similar willingness.
Despite the accelerating buildup of Russian forces along the Ukraine border, State Department spokesman Ned Price says there is still time for diplomacy, but stated it must take place in the context of de-escalation. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan updated congressional leaders on the situation, reportedly saying new military and economic options are being considered. Florida Senator Marco Rubio, the top Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee, said an invasion would lead to crippling sanctions on Russia's economy.
The key here is not just building sanctions that hurt at the front end, but can you sustain them long enough to change behavior and hopefully change outcomes?
U.S. and foreign intelligence suggests Russia could invade as early as tomorrow. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked never-used-before legislation to crack down on trucker protests blocking border crossings.
The federal government has invoked the Emergencies Act to supplement provincial and territorial capacity.
The act allows the temporary suspension of civil liberties. Washington, D.C. is dropping its vaccine mandate for indoor venues today, as Mayor Muriel Bowser says the city is in a much better place.
Since the height of Omicron wave entered the district in December, cases have dropped more than 90%.
D.C. will also drop its indoor mask requirements on March 1st, except in schools. On the Senate floor, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell blasted Democratic cities still requiring masks in schools.
The political left has put kids last. That's simply not acceptable. American families deserve normalcy.
Several Republican senators are speaking out against creating a federal no-fly list of unruly passengers, saying such restrictions should be left to the airlines, not the government. The FAA had nearly 6,000 unruly passenger reports in 2021, the majority related to mask mandates. A libel lawsuit former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin filed against the New York Times is being tossed out. A U.S. district judge said an editorial was not malicious in linking Palin to a 2011 deadly shooting spree in Arizona. The Texas GOP says New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is out of touch with voters after she told San Antonio rallygoers that the state will inevitably go blue.
It will happen. The only question is when.
The last time Texas voted for a Democratic president was Jimmy Carter in 1976. The White House isn't commenting on a legal filing in special counsel John Durham's Russia collusion probe. It alleges Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign spied on Trump Tower and the White House. And after cutting ties with Trump Enterprises, the former president's longtime financial advisor said statements prepared between 2011 and 2020 should not be relied upon. Those documents are at the heart of two investigations into Trump's financial dealings. Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The threat of Russian invasion of Ukraine has led many to question the role that China will play in the conflict. Both China and Russia oppose greater expansion of NATO, but does that mean they will cooperate on other issues too? Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Will China bail out Russia over Ukraine? Reports out of Washington suggest worry over a Russia-China partnership that would facilitate Vladimir Putin's presumed ambition to absorb Ukraine and undermine the NATO-based European security system. Such worry exaggerates the depth of the partnership and ignores the limits of China's commitment to it. When it comes to support of China on international issues, from human rights to Taiwan, Beijing can always count on Putin's Russia, and the reverse is generally true. In numerous meetings since Xi Jinping and Putin became top leaders, the China-Russia relationship has been consistently described in the most exalted terms. They're dear friends. They have the best relations in history. They're a model of interstate cooperation in the 21st century, etc. China-Russia's trade has risen substantially every year. China is Russia's most important trade partner. Joint military maneuvers have become a regular event. Symbolizing their closeness, Putin is attending the Beijing Winter Olympics. China and Russia are aligned with one another in viewing the United States as their principal opponent and chief obstacle to the achievement of their respective aims in Asia and Europe. But theirs is a marriage of convenience, not a security alliance. They're divided by many issues, including a history of conflicting national interests and ideological differences, unresolved territorial claims, and the large gap between them in economy and technology. While U.S. analyses typically lump China and Russia together as threats to U.S. national security, they're actually far apart in their international conduct. Unlike Russia, China has taken full advantage of globalization in everything from contributions to UN peacekeeping and tourism to scholarly and scientific exchanges and overseas investments, notably with the United States. Putin's visit to China at the height of the crisis over Ukraine prompted comparisons between Russian and Chinese diplomacy over, respectively, Ukraine and Taiwan. On the surface, Russian and Chinese views seem similar. Putin and Xi commonly believe those territories cannot be considered independent states, historically and culturally belong to the mother country, and are only prevented from being absorbed because of foreign interference. Yet they know full well that populations in Ukraine and Taiwan reject absorption. But there the similarities end. Putin sees Ukraine as a security threat because of NATO's eastward expansion and has deployed forces along Ukraine's border sufficient to take over the country. His ultimate goal, many observers believe, is to reconstruct the European security order. In contrast, Xi has so far abided by the stated goal of peaceful unification of Taiwan. China has displayed its military capabilities in the Taiwan area, but has not threatened Taiwan with attack or asserted that Taiwan poses a threat to the mainland. Nor has China sought to arouse a pro-China force inside Taiwan or demanded that the U.S. alliance system in Asia be dismantled. China's policy on the Ukraine crisis only seems to entail guarded support of Russia. The final Putin-Xi text on their talks reflected that view. Contrary to what some experts are saying, China did not promise military support of Russia, nor suggest the idea of an alliance. The joint statement did not mention Ukraine at all, merely saying, quote, the two sides oppose continual expansion of NATO and call for NATO to reject the ideology of the Cold War and respect other countries' sovereignty, security, interests, and multicultural diversity. Tellingly, the lengthy statement devoted far more space to other issues, such as cooperation on the pandemic, trade, arms control, and a whole range of common threats from the West. If open conflict with Ukraine were to occur, China would no doubt help offset sanctions on Russian energy exports, but don't count on China doing more than that. Keep in mind that although China did support Russia's recent interventions in Kazakhstan and Belarus to quell potential regime changes, it did not support Russia's seizure of Crimea in 2014. Maintaining a common front with Russia against the West is one thing. Going along with a Russian territorial grab is another. The economic and political consequences of a Russian invasion of Ukraine would reach far beyond Europe. A war, even if only economic, would further alienate China from both Europe and the United States, harm China's economy, and perhaps show Xi's peaceful unification policy on Taiwan in a bad light. At bottom, Russia needs China far more than China needs Russia. Thus, China prefers a diplomatic resolution over Ukraine. The United States should stop conflating China with Russia. Their mutual admiration conceals more than it reveals. Thanks for listening. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs will take on reforms after journalists investigated their practices. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Bureau of Indian Affairs announced Monday reforms to its tribal jails. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck reports.
A Mountain West News Bureau and NPR investigation found a pattern of neglect and misconduct that led to more than a dozen inmate deaths. The BIA then hired a consultant to review the deaths, and now it's proposing changes it wants to make. That includes more training on how to perform in-custody death investigations. Assistant Secretary of the Interior Brian Newland put it this way.
The report lays out recommendations for the department informed by an assessment of the thoroughness and effectiveness of in-custody death investigations.
However, the BIA's proposed changes don't include harsher penalties for misconduct by jail employees or more medical personnel in tribal jails. Newland also said he was looking into whether the agency's contract with Darryl Cruzan to review the deaths followed laws and regulations. Some congressmen have been critical of the contract because, as an interior official, Cruzan oversaw tribal corrections during seven of the deaths. After leaving the agency, he became a consultant and his firm won the contract to review the jail deaths. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
Native Youth Monday laid out top priorities for the National Congress of American Indians. Two members of the NCAI Youth Commission delivered remarks prior to the State of Indian Nations address. Youth leaders Simon Friday and Jessica Lambert say education and climate issues are major concerns. They say there needs to be better Native American representation in public schools with the expansion of history lessons, which should include a focus on modern American Indians. The youth leaders say more needs to be done to address climate change and protect land and water. Lambert says the Youth Commission is worried about the mental well-being of Native young people across the country.
It is crucial to create spaces and provide resources for tribal youth that are struggling with mental health and generational well-being, as well as helping tribal youth, in addition to all Natives, understand how to enact true preventative health care through lifestyle choices. The first step to doing this is taking away the stigma associated with battling mental health issues and re-emphasizing our strong cultures, as it is our practices and ways of living that often allow us to live healthy lives.
This was the first time Native youth took part in the annual speech. The Youth Commission seeks solutions for challenges facing tribal communities. They meet with the Native leaders and inform advocacy decisions. Following the remarks, National Congress of American Indians President Fawn Sharp delivered the State of Indian Nations address, discussing key issues, achievements, and funding goals. Sharp says tribes need to continue to improve government-to-government relationships, seeing progress with the historic confirmation of Deb Haaland as Interior Secretary. She says there are expansions in policies and highlighted tribal funding in Biden's infrastructure law. There have been many strides and promises fulfilled, Sharp says, but she encouraged leaders to keep the government accountable.
While the historic investments into Indian country over the past year are progress to solve the centuries of mistrust, we must keep fighting forward to hold the federal government to its trust responsibility to every tribal nation.
Sharp touched on the ongoing pandemic, broadband, sacred sites, mascots, boarding schools, and a number of other issues. Her 30-minute speech was part of NCAI's winter session. The day-long event with government officials and members of Congress was held on a virtual platform. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 15th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Caitlin Backus, Josh Salem, and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, Emily Scott, and Lily Bolke. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for It Did Happen Here.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
I'm going to own right here that I was actually born and raised pretty racist. I'm from a little teeny town where we rode bulls and uncles are cowboys and tote guns and all that stuff. But I didn't know any better. Like, I didn't have anyone around. But my aunt took in foster kids. I had a lot of foster cousins, some Hispanic, a couple young men from India. We were all together. We were all family. We were all brothers. We're all just people. We are no different. You're from here. You're from there. Everyone is flailing. Everyone's faking it till they make it. So as I was getting a little older, I started putting two and two together that actually the white power guys were creating a bunch of BS for everybody. So it really lost its power for me.
That was Michael Clark, who took what was called direct action to kick Nazi scum out of the Rose City. Welcome to episode 10 of It Did Happen Here, Sharper Times. I'm Selena Flores.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. In this episode, we hear from the people who were part of SHARP,